Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. It seems like it's been a long week. Thank goodness Friday is here. Welcome to tonight's program. We're going to give away a podcast subscription. Either this hour or next hour, not sure. As we are wont to do on Friday evenings, all I have to do is get the right answer to our podcast trivia question, and you get a one-year subscription free Malloy program, podcast downloads, commercial free, yada, yada, yada. How about those American sailors rescuing those Iranian sailors from the clutches of Somali pirates today? Huh? Wasn't that something? Of course, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be, but there are too many people on Earth who want to see those American sailors and those Iranian sailors spilling each other's blood. What a shame. We're going to talk about that a little bit later tonight, too. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba-ba. As you know, the Super Bowl is going to be held this year in Indianapolis, Indiana. And Indiana lawmakers are considering a bill that would turn Indiana into a so-called right-to-work state, which is another one of those memes, just like a woman's right to choose, that totally obscures or changes what the objective is. Remember, Roe v. Wade was about a woman's right to privacy. And banning unions from a state like we have here in Georgia, not banning them, but banning compulsory membership in a union as a criterion or a one of several criteria for accepting a job is it's not a right to work. It's a right to be denied the right to collective bargaining. It is a right for the corporatists or the capitalists to not have to deal with a unified workforce that says, look, we want a living wage. Look, as long as we live in a society that does not provide single-payer health care, you have to provide it for us as a condition of our working here. A union would demand, look, we want safety in the workplace. We want to make sure that the electrical system really works. We want to make sure as we work on this god-awful assembly line that we don't get electrocuted because you, Mr. Corporatist, have decided to cut corners where it concerns your electrical wiring. No, see, that's what right to work is. The right to work state is a state that says, yeah, you have a right to work, all right, but it's your ass if anything happens. There's going to be no union to protect you. Now, how does this tie in with the Super Bowl? Well, the union representing NFL players spoke out today against that bill that's on the table in Indiana. And the NFL Players Association argued that the legislation in Indiana is merely a political ploy. That's their term, a political ploy that would drive down workers' wages if it became law. Hello, and you think they're dumbass football players, huh? Well, they know about unions, don't they? Oh, do they ever? The National Football League Players Association said in a statement, quote, NFL players know what it means to fight for workers' rights, better pensions, and health and safety in the workplace. The right to work bill is not about jobs or rights, and it's the wrong priority for Indiana, end quote. How about that? How about that? You go, NFL Players Association. The right to work laws, so-called, are generally supported and advocated by business groups. Now, remember last night I told you about the full-page ad run by an AstroTurf group set up by one man, and he calls himself the Center for Union Rights or the Center for Union Freedom or some such bat crap. And it turns out he's another little corporate whore, no offense to real sex workers, just a little corporate whore that runs around Washington setting up these fake AstroTurf organizations who then try to destroy one more piece of Americana. Well, that's stirred up. That full-page ad has stirred up a lot of people, and not in the way that this scum-sucking group of one thought it would stir people up. The Indiana bill has broad support, of course, among that state's Republican majority in the General Assembly. Of course it does. And Republican Governor Mitch Daniels, formerly of the Bush administration. But anyway, unions and labor groups have put together an advertising campaign to fight against this. Business owners, the corporatists, the little tin-horn capitalists and their allies argue that employees shouldn't be forced to join unions. Forced? How about just given an honest-to-God choice? How about just laying it all out? Bring in a National Labor Relations Board, now that Obama has used recess appointments to fill that board that the Republicans refused to confirm, the people he nominated. Let's bring in the NLRB. And let's sit over here, a union rep, and sit over here, a rep from the corporation or the capitalist who is going to open a factory someplace. And let's leave the threats and intimidation out of it. You know, the corporatists can't sit there and say things as they usually do. Well, if you're going to have unions here, we'll take the goddamn factory down to Mississippi. No, none of that. None of that. And the union can't sit there and say, all right, if we don't get everything we want, we're going to burn the goddamn place down. No, none of that. Okay, now, the NLRB referee will say, okay, gentlemen, ladies, present your arguments. So the corporatist presents the capitalist argument, and the union presents the worker argument. And the workers, or the would-be workers, sitting there, then get to choose right then, right there. Now, honestly, which option do you think the worker would take? That's right. The NFL Players Association cited a report from the Economic Policy Institute, that is a liberal organization, that says, based on evidence, that the right to work bill would lower wages for both union and non-union workers in Indiana by about $1,500 annually. Now, if you have a million non-unionized workers in Indiana, just a million, what does that work out to? What's a million times 1,500? It's over $1 billion, isn't it? The bill also, being considered by these Indiana cretins, would make it more difficult for workers to secure health care, a pension. Eh? Now, noting that the upcoming Super Bowl will be hosted by Indianapolis, a city that will suck up tens of millions of dollars from this, the union called on Indiana lawmakers to get their heads out of their asses and act like adults. Just stop it. Stop trying to destroy collective bargaining. Just stop it. They didn't put it that way. That's the way I put it. The Players Association said, quote, "This Super Bowl should be about celebrating the best of what Indianapolis has to offer, not about legislation that hurts the people of Indiana," end quote. Right-to-work legislation has been pushed in a handful of states this year, notably over in New Hampshire, where union leaders cheered Democratic Governor John Lynch's veto of a right-to-work bill passed by the Republican corporate capitalist-controlled members of that state's legislation. Good on you, National Football League. Good on you. I'll be damned. In thanks for this, I'm going to watch Atlanta kick whoever their opponent's ass is this year. We'll be right back.
Maybe you're alone. Guy Show. Talk radio matters here.
Yes, it does. 21 past the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Cherrell. And her message, happy birthday, Sanchez. Sanchez, thanks for your integrity, your political passion, your sense of justice, your sense of humor, and good company. Good friends are what it's all about. Much love, Cherrell. Well, isn't that sweet? Thanks, Cherrell. And Sanchez, happy birthday. You should have told us. We would have, every year we give away a brand new Jeep. Just kidding. Happy birthday, Sanchez. And thank you very much, Cherrell, for the sponsorship. And tell you what, regarding Indiana, if Indiana will just stop the nonsense and do away with this proposed legislation to take away the rights of workers to get together and bargain collectively for their own well-being, not at the expense of shutting down a factory. I don't think a union has ever wanted to do that. That would be like, you know, like a chicken wanting to go to work for Colonel Sanders. It's not that at all. It's simply the right to bargain collectively, the right to be a countervailing force against capitalism, which knows no mercy, has no respect for workers, no respect for workers' wages, workers' health, workers' rights, none of it. So I'll tell you what, Indiana, I will, if you'll drop that legislation, I'll not mention the fact that you are one of the many birthplaces of the KKK. There have been three waves of the Klan in this country. The first one was Pulaski, Tennessee, right after Civil War. Second one was right here, not far, Kathy, from where we have the Molloy compound. As a matter of fact, at one time, I think this was before you and I met, I happened to meet old Mr. Venable, the guy that owned the mountain on which the KKK reconstituted itself. And then the third one, of course, somewhere in there, is the fact that the Indiana site, and I forget what city it was, but it was very instrumental in reconstituting the Klan. I won't mention that again. If the people in Indiana, the legislators, you Republican thugs, if you will stop the nonsense about workers, okay? Speaking of the KKK, am I reading this right? From the Chicago Tribune, Chicago's Catholic Cardinal Francis George apologized today for remarks that he made on Christmas Day comparing the upcoming Gay Pride Parade to the Ku Klux Klan. You know, if you were a person happened to be homosexual, I mean, at what point do you explode? At what point do you just go berserk and say you've had enough with the insults and the demeaning statements and the horror directed against you from everybody, from the Cardinal of Chicago, it's not a baseball team, the Cardinal of Chicago, all the way to those crazy bastards at the Westboro Baptist Church in Kansas, and everything in between, blaming you, castigating you, yelling at you, calling you less than human, saying that you're condemned to burn in hell. I mean, at what point? Good God, at what point? I'm sorry. Cardinal Francis George said today, quote, "I am truly sorry for the hurt my remarks have caused." He said this in an interview with the Chicago Tribune. "Particularly because we all have friends or family members who are gay and lesbian. This has evidently wounded a good number of people. I have family members myself who are gay and lesbian. So it's part of our lives, so I'm sorry for the hurt," end quote. Cardinal Francis George. His comments came in response to questions about whether the new route assigned to next summer's Gay Pride Parade would interrupt morning services at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church. No, it's not Caramel, Mike. Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church in the Lakeview neighborhood. The dispute was resolved before Christmas when parade organizers agreed to change the start time of the event. Cardinal George said, "When I was talking, I was speaking out of fear that I have for the church's liberty." What? "And I was reaching for an analogy which was very inappropriate, for which I'm sorry. I didn't realize the impact of what I was saying." And you see, Cardinal George, that's the problem right there. That you, one of the princes of the church, you, Cardinal George, a messenger of Jesus Christus, and you didn't realize the impact of what you were saying, comparing people who happen to be gay to the Klan.
Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, and this hour is being sponsored by Cherrell, whose message is Happy Birthday, Sanchez. Thanks for your integrity, your political passion, your sense of justice, your sense of humor, and good company. Good friends are what it's all about. Much love, Cherrell. Nice message, Jarell. Thanks for the sponsorship, too. And happy birthday, Sanchez. One more thing on Cardinal Francis George. I can't believe his statement. He didn't realize the impact of what he was saying. He followed that up by saying sometimes fear is a bad motivation. What he said was, He was addressing what he perceived to be religious discrimination in the name of gay rights, you know, which is so ass backwards. This is what just irritates me beyond belief. You have organizations that are religious. They do things that are secular or that requires public money, and they demand the right to display or participate in whatever bigotry their religion demands, and every religion demands bigotry. That's one of the organizing principles of religion, is to separate the believer from the other, whoever the other happens to be. And because we live in a secular society with laws, the federal government or various governments say, no, you can't do that. You can't discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation. And that's all the statement is. The statement doesn't say, all right, you have to welcome gays into your congregation. That's not what it says. These laws, equal protection laws, do not say to priests, rabbis, imams, or preachers, whoever, you must marry gay people in your church. It doesn't say that. And it never would. But the religious bigots, like Cardinal George here, whether his bigotry is conscious or just second nature, which in this case appears to be just second nature, even though he claims he has gay folk in his family. But to turn it around, to turn the discrimination practiced by religious organizations against gay people, to turn it around and say, well, if we have to abide by the laws of this country, if we're going to do certain things, then you're discriminating against us! You sick bastards. This is why I despise anything that even has a faint hint of a stench of religion. because it's based on demonizing the other. Oh, I know all the fancy, go, well, there are many, many mansions in God's house. Or no, there's not. There's only yours. There's only yours. And in this case, it's only Francis Cardinal George's, or Cardinal Francis George, whatever. Cardinal Francis George is the one who made the statement. And what he said was, you know, you don't want the gay liberation movement to morph into something like the Ku Klux Klan demonstrating in the streets against Catholicism. Morphing into something like the Ku Klux Klan. Does Cardinal Francis George not understand what the KKK was? Or does he simply have such a problem with homosexuality that he has no problem in equating it to the violence and terror and lynchings and burnings and beatings and murders of the KKK? Cardinal Francis George, I have news for you, you addle-brained halfwit. Gay people don't go out and find Catholics and beat them up. Gay people do not put on hoods and ride into the night and come to one of your tacky churches and burn it down. You got it ass backwards, Mr. Francis Cardinal George. But then again, you religious freaks usually do. Your apology sucks. To think that a prince of the church. Isn't that what they call cardinals? Huh? Don't you get to vote on who the next direct spokesperson from God will be inside your corrupt organization, Cardinal Francis George? You do get to vote, right? How are you going to vote? How many of your popes have been gay? How many of your priests are gay? How many of your bishops are gay? How many of your archbishops are gay? How many of your nuns are gay? What goddamn difference does it make? Whoops. Chris Pat, president of Dignity Chicago, an independent ministry for gay, lesbian, and transgender Catholics, welcomed the cardinal's apology. Cardinal Francis George said he never expected the public uproar over his comments. Of course, they never do. They never do.
What? What did I say? I'm just talking about the queers. What? What's everybody getting their balls in an uproar for? What? They're just queers. I mean, my God, they're not normal people. I mean, if I would have said something about Democrats or Republicans or Baptists, okay, but I'm talking about queers.
Boom, 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 boom. This is from the website National Jewish Democratic Committee. Is that what it is? NJDC? As further evidence of the incongruence between Republican presidential candidate, former Senator Rick Santorum, and the vast majority of American Jews, Santorum declared yesterday that, quote, we always need a Jesus candidate. End quote. More than an economic candidate. Santorum told the audience about a radio interview out of Boston he did earlier today. According to Santorum, the interviewer said, we don't need a Jesus candidate. We need an economic candidate. Santorum said, my answer to that was, we always need a Jesus candidate. He added, we need someone who believes in something more than themselves and not just the economy. God bless America. Do we mean that when we say it, or do we just say it when we say it? Look, not to get into a theological discussion with you, along the lines of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, Mr. Sick Santorum, but God, I know your religion claims that God and Jesus are part of a triad, but there are a lot of people who believe in your God who don't accept the divinity of your Messiah. So, you know, the two terms are not interchangeable unless you happen to be an evangelical kind of Christian. What are you? What are you, Rick? Sick? I guess he's Catholic, right? I think he's Catholic. Sick, what you ought to do is call Francis Cardinal George out in Chicago, and maybe you and he can get together for a cup of hemlock. We always need a Jesus candidate. I guess he means this go around himself. It's madness. It's just crazy stuff. There's so much going on, and I sit here and talk about this. The reason I talk about it is just it's just so infuriating to me. I hate newspeak. I hate the destruction or deconstruction of language. I hate to see an organization like the Catholic Church that has been one of the bloodiest, most suppressive, most oppressive, most violent organizations in the history of not just religion, but of the entire human race, try to claim victim status because a bunch of queers want to march or parade down the goddamn street. That's what drives me crazy. And because gay folk want to form a contract that has nothing to do with Catholics or Hindus or Buddhists or Zoroastrians or Shintoists or meditators or people with athlete's foot. It's a contract. But these religious fanatics, oh no, you will de-sanctify marriage. Marriage is not sanctified. It is vested in the sanctimonious bastards by the various states. It is not unlike the old Soviet Union, where if you wanted to get married, you'd go to the local registrar and get your ass married. And in the United States, if you want to get married, you take yourself to the local county registrar and get your ass married. It's very simple. Until the religious fanatics say, oh no! If the queers get married, why, I may be forced to divorce my wife! Okay, that's all. Do we have a break here? Oh, good. All right, when we come back, a little bit more. I got an email here from Kay, kaysreportcard.com, about what we were talking about unions the other night. And also want to welcome Columbus, WVKO, 1580 AM, Cleveland, WABQ, 1460 AM, and Palm Springs, California, KPTR, 1450 AM. Thank you, three radio stations, for carrying this program. I hope you'll stay with me, even though I'm probably the most profane program on the air.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, they go together like a horse and carriage. This I'll tell you, brother, you can't have one without the an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry, and they will say it's elementary. Try to separate them. It's an illusion. Try.
You're listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
10 before the hour, and this hour has been sponsored in honor of Sanchez's birthday. Sherelle has sponsored it. Her message, or Sherelle's message. Happy birthday, Sanchez. Thanks for your integrity, your political passion, your sense of justice, your sense of humor, and good company. Good friends are what it's all about. Much love, Sherelle. Nice stuff, Sherelle. Thank you, and happy birthday, Sanchez. Next hour, we will we're going to take some phone calls, and also at the bottom of the hour, podcast trivia. Phone number here is 877-996-2556. From Kay Petrini, our education affairs correspondent. Mike, so let me get this straight. Being a union member whose dues are automatically deducted from one's paycheck is somehow an infringement on employee freedom? That's what the Kim Jong crazy ad in yesterday's New York Times implies. This lie spread by the predatory capitalists just infuriates me. Jim, that's her husband. Jim was a union member for many years. During that time, he never once complained about paying his union dues. Why? Well, because for that nominal monthly amount, we received full health, dental, and vision coverage, a solid life insurance policy, and several other perks that the average non-union employee would consider luxuries. In the union, all of these things were considered basic necessities. As Prairie 2 reported last night, quote, new U.S. manufacturing jobs only pay $15 an hour if you're lucky. Manufacturing jobs in Germany pay $56 an hour. Their new unemployment numbers are the lowest since Mr. Gorbachev tore down that wall. End quote, Prairie 2 last night. Kay goes on, this fact runs counter to every Republican economic talking point about, quote, unshackling the markets from regulation is necessary to create jobs, end quote. Not only is Germany a country that still manufactures goods and has strong unions, but there, employers and employees are required by law to pay into a single-payer health insurance system. The employer pays half of the cost for each employee. The employee pays the other half. The money is automatically deducted, and no one even thinks twice about it, let alone considers it an infringement on his or her freedom. That's because when a German worker, employed or unemployed, becomes sick, injured, or otherwise incapacitated, the system is there for him or her. People fall into a social safety net as opposed to smashing into the cold concrete sidewalk that awaits them here, often literally. German citizens are covered by the system into which they pay. They do not have to fear becoming destitute, a fear that has been realized for millions of Americans over the past three decades while the unions have been destroyed. Ask a union member, like my husband, or a typical German worker, whether they feel shackled by the dues they pay. They will laugh as they point out that being required to pay into the system, whether a union trust fund or a single-payer healthcare system, or both, that requirement is the source of their freedom. Freedom from fear of illness, poverty, hunger. The things that enslave millions of so-called free Americans every single day. To paraphrase Orwell, freedom from those pesky unions is slavery for the American worker. And as long as Americans continue to buy into this bull crap, their standard of living will continue to deteriorate, while the 1% drink the champagne on their balconies overlooking Wall Street. Kay. You can go to her website if you like, kaysreportcard.com. Yeah, I have had some problems with my union. They were mostly problems of personality and some incompetence on the part of some of their staff. But by and large, my union is how I get my health care. It's how Kathy gets hers. It's how Molly gets hers. My union provides me retirement benefits when it's time to take them. So the point is, I am eligible for Medicare right now. I don't take it. I have an insurance policy through my union that covers me, my wife, my child. And like Kay's husband, it also covers dental work. It also covers vision. It's my union. Do I feel shackled? Do I feel like, and I'm in a right-to-work state. Didn't make any difference. When I worked for Air America, we had a collective bargaining agreement that applied no matter where we were. The state of Georgia could literally kiss my hindquarters. I was a union member and have been and will be until I stop work. shackled my ass. God, I hate these people. Have I mentioned that yet tonight? All right, we have a break here. Over this break, we shall be opening up the phone line. So if you'd like to call in to make a comment or two, we will do that. And at the bottom of this hour coming up, we'll do podcast trivia where you can win 1 year commercial-free podcast subscription to this program. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Here and then to your phone calls. Today is Friday. I finally got around to last Sunday's New York Times book review section. There's a new book out called The Partnership, and it's written by Philip Taubman, who is a former reporter and editor for the New York Times. And the title is The Partnership: Five Cold Warriors and Their Quest to Ban the Bomb. Now, you may disagree with whether or not this group really wants to ban the bomb or individual members, but he's talking about Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, William Perry, Sam Nunn, and Sidney Drell, an influential Stanford physicist. But it's worth, the review is worth a read, and it's one of those books you might want to get to read. I'm debating it because it probably scared the hell out of me. But listen, the reviewer, Gary Bass, the way he begins this, this is what got me. On the day after a nuclear bomb annihilates Washington, New Delhi, Islamabad, Seoul, Tel Aviv, or Moscow, vaporizing and burning to death hundreds of thousands of people, our present complacency about nuclear proliferation will look like daylight madness. Even the chilliest of realists have shuddered at our capability for radioactive massacre. In 1977, the strategist George F. Kennan declared, quote, "No one is good enough, wise enough, steady enough to have control over the volume of explosives that now rest in the hands of this country." Nuclear arms, he concluded, shouldn't exist at all. That's something we don't talk about anymore. That's something I grew up with. If you're over a certain age, you grew up with it too. Duck and cover and all that stuff. Yeah. But everybody is under the misconception, not everybody, the general consensus is we don't have to think about nuclear annihilation any longer because, well, you know, the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union dissolved itself. No, Reagan had nothing to do with it. Oh, Jesus Christ. So, since there is no longer a Cold War, there's no need to worry about nuclear proliferation or nuclear bombs or what have you. Wrong. Kissinger said, Kissinger, a mass murderer, one of the people in a global history that is drenched in blood. I don't know how he's still alive. He's in his 80s. And you would think that the weight of the people he's responsible for killing would have crushed him to the earth by now, but he's still alive. And he says, quote, "It is not possible for the United States to say nobody else can proliferate or build up nuclear arsenals while we continue to rely entirely on nuclear weapons," end quote. Now, that's a very good quote, and too bad it came out of the demon mouth of Henry Kissinger, because Kissinger is one of those who made millions upon millions upon millions of dollars because of the nuclear armaments race. And as the reviewer points out, some of the most volatile regional conflicts, say between India and Pakistan, on the Korean Peninsula, in the Middle East, now involve nuclear weapons. Nuclear deterrence between, say, Israel and Iran may prove a lot less stable than the Cold War kind. Well, of course. When you have somebody like Netanyahu across a nuclear divide with someone like Ahmadinejad, it's a little bit different from even Khrushchev and Kennedy. It's a little bit different from Reagan and Gorbachev. But I digress. Worse, the reviewer writes, fledgling nuclear powers lacking the safeguards that the United States and the Soviet Union eventually developed, fledgling nuclear powers will risk fatal misjudgments or accidents. Scott Sagan has painstakingly, that's the guy who wrote, well, no, he didn't. The book is written by Philip Taubman. He's quoting someone else. Scott Sagan has painstakingly documented such blunders in the American nuclear arsenal in a petrifying but essential book titled The Limits of Safety. For example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I didn't know this until today. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the wrong military twitch could have ignited Armageddon, a California Air Force base launched an unarmed ICBM as part of a previously scheduled test that somehow had not been canceled. Now, imagine India and Pakistan on high alert. Oh, and remember, the newer nuclear states are vulnerable to coups, infiltration, profiteering, or theft. Just thought I would toss that out in case you don't have enough to give you the heebie-jeebies. Richard is in Denver, listening on XM. Hello, Richard.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. I wanted to say thank you for what you do. I'm actually, surprisingly, I'm probably more of an independent now, but Republican Christian, and I have to agree with you on this religious thing. I am absolutely tired of politicians hiding behind religion. It is what you said about Stan Farm is dead on. If he wants to be a Christian and prove that to the people that are going to be potentially voting for him, he really needs to just show it in action and not parade it.
Well, that's what Jesus said. You know, when he had his ministry, he talked about, I'm deeply paraphrasing, but if you're going to talk the talk, you also have to walk the walk.
Exactly.
And don't be a Pharisee. Don't be someone who professes a belief. Live your belief. So, I just wish that all politicians would please, you know, they're not being elected pope. That's what the College of Cardinals does. They're not being selected to head the Southern Baptist Convention. What they are being selected to do, or at least we have the illusion that they're being selected to do, is to run the country. That means economics. That means environmental issues. It means public health. It means a failing economy. It means international relations. It doesn't mean pounding somebody over the head with your particular religious belief and expecting that that's going to make you president.
Exactly, and I don't know anywhere biblically where it says that they should be doing that, let alone judging people for their beliefs. I think I caught your program on the way home from work where you were talking about gays and lesbians. I mean, if you're a Bible-following Christian, why are you even making a comment? You know, you might not approve of it, but you're not there to judge people at all. I mean, I don't understand why people can't separate, why they have to point fingers and judge people and act like that everybody's better than everybody, because that's just not the case.
Well, with respect to your beliefs, Richard, that though is one of the foundational aspects of religion. With one or two exceptions, I don't want to include certain theological belief systems, perhaps, that don't do this, and there are a couple. But for the vast majority of religion is based on the idea of pointing at someone else and saying, "Repent," you know, "Repent." Well, what do you mean, repent? Well, what I mean by repent is you're not following my particular belief, and you must know that my particular belief is the only correct one. You know, that sort of thing. All right, Richard, listen, I got to leave there. Here comes the commercials. Thank you very much. I'm glad you called, and I hope you call again. Take care, sir.
They nailed him in the air, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Well, the people held their breath when they heard about his death. Everybody wondered why. It was the landlord and the soldiers that he hired to nail Jesus Christ in the sky. This song was made in New York City of rich mans and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach like he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave.
All right, we're going to come back to your calls here in just a second. Podcast trivia after the next break. Well, let's do some phone calls right now. Jim is in Las Vegas, listening on Sirius. Hey, Jim.
Hey, what's up, Mike?
You are, I hope.
Okay. I'm just wondering, I'm kind of a little bit depressed, dejected about Bachman dropping out. Maybe she didn't have enough of a busload of faith to get by, you think?
Could be. Wait a minute. You're depressed that Bachman dropped out?
A little bit of sarcasm there.
Oh. I thought maybe you meant you were depressed she dropped out because there goes probably one of the more humorous of the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to pick. I mean,
which one's the funniest?
They're all total whack jobs.
they really are. But Bachman, Bachman with her great big, her B&G husband, dancing. Every time he got around her, he wanted to beach dance. You know, that little dance tip that they do, that's what they did over here in South Carolina back in the 60s and 70s. It's called shag dancing. And, you know, every time I saw that B&G freak grab her, "Hey, honey, you want to dance?" You know what B&G means, don't you?
Oh, yeah?
Do you know what B&G means when you're referring to some guy, B&G?
Buying gay? I don't know.
No, big and goofy.
Oh.
But that's close enough. Jim, I got to move on. Thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. Kevin is in Tucson. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, Mike, how's it going? I love your passion, buddy, so keep it up.
Okay, I'll try.
Hey, yeah, good. Hey, I just wanted to make a comment on the Cardinal And you know, as despicable as the man is and the comment he made, at least he didn't try to deny he said it. Not like Rick Santorum when he said black and he's on radio saying, hey, no, I didn't say black. I said blah.
Yeah.
You know, if Cardinal said, hey, I said it and I'm sorry. So, you know, at least we know that Cardinals have maintained one level above politicians.
Well, in a different time, different place, I might debate that with you, but I do agree with you. At least Francis Cardinal George had the presence to go ahead and claim what he said. But the fact that he said he was unaware. Or whatever it was he said. He was unaware that what he said would be taken the way it was or something to that effect. And that's the part that I just found unacceptable.
Like I said, it's despicable what he said. Yeah. I mean, you know, there isn't any doubt about it. But, you know, again, at least he admitted to it. You know, he lived up to it.
That's
you
true.
Know, what's with Santorum that supposedly, you know, a man of God as well, you know, right. in a different way, right. you know, lying on national TV and radio that he didn't say what he said.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that's really despicable.
It is. It definitely is. Kevin, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say. You're right about the Cardinal. At least he did claim it. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah. Isn't Cardinal George the one that you've got the picture, you and he? Was that Francis Cardinal George?
Yeah, I think so.
When we lived in Chicago, Kathy was in school, and I was working at WLS, and we needed some extra money, so she took a job at a catering company. But you were a...
catering service.
Yeah, but you were... What do you call that? You were a server, yeah. You used to wear the tux, but what's the name of those companies? Not catering. What do you call them? There's another term for it. Anyway, one of the gigs that she did was at the official residence of the cardinal. This is before he was made a cardinal. He was bishop or archbishop. And it was one of those old architecturally mind-blowing buildings in Chicago that the Catholic Church had bought. And Kathy was one of the people that the company that she worked for, she put on her little tux and off she went with some of her coworkers. I guess there were about five men and women who took this gig. And she got her picture taken for the sheer hell of it. Wasn't there a story around that, or am I thinking of something else? What was the...
I think you're thinking about the time that I met Dan Quayle.
Oh, yeah, you had your picture taken with Dan Quayle, too.
I have a picture taken with Dan Quayle, which I still have framed somewhere.
Yeah, because you were serving at some... what do you call those companies? Come on.
Staffing services?
Staffing. Thank you very much. A staffing company that was based at Loyola. Your company was on the grounds at Loyola University on the north side of Chicago. And... So Kathy would get these gigs where she would go, you know, carry a tray around or make sure the tables were cleaned and serve food and yada, yada, yada. And the deal with Dan Quayle, you told him you were a big fan so that he would give that toothy grin and you'd get your picture taken with him.
I'm taller than he is.
You are taller than he is. You're better looking, too. We'll be right back. Oh, trivia when we come back. Come on, get on the phone. Get on the phone. Here we go. Subscription free, I might add, to Malloy Program podcast downloads, one in your email box every single day for a year. No commercials, just fun frivolity and barely disguised madness. All you have to do is get the correct answer to our trivia question tonight. We have a victim or a contestant, Steve in Framingham, Mass. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
All right.
The banker.
Yeah, I know Steve the banker.
Yeah.
I thought you'd won one of these already.
No, I've never played.
Oh my God! All right, are you ready?
And playing one of these things. Look, I'm not good at
Yeah, well, no excuses. Come on. Man up. We're going to do trivia here. All right, here we go. Maestro, start the music for trivia. Harumph! All right, Steve, this is a multiple choice question. All you have to do is get the right answer and you win. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum this week in New Hampshire introduced America to a new racial group. Was it A, Pinks, B, Gers, C, Blahs, or D, Forps?
Blahs.
Blahs! Okay. See how easy that was?
God.
You know, it's not like an algebra exam. I mean,
I was sweating this out for 5 minutes.
Oh, my God.
I looked at that, and I didn't say that. If you look at it, what I started to say is a word and then sort of changed, and it sort of blew, it came out. And
That's Rick. Yeah. Well, play
That's
what
the funniest thing I ever heard. I love hearing him explain that.
All right, listen, Steve. Play what he said.
Blight people's lives better by giving them somebody else's
money. No, start
to,
it over
to make blight people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money.
Blah, people's lives better. Well, that's good.
Oh, that's the greatest. I love that.
Thinking about it. All right, now, before...
I almost want him to win the presidency so we can hear that every day.
Oh, my God. No, don't. No, don't do that. All right, I'll tell you what. Now, before we hang up, I'll put you on hold and Kathy will get the pertinent information. But you wanted to talk about the economy, too, right?
I guess after that, I'm not sure. God, I don't even know how to follow up with all these great Republican guys and women who are running. I don't even know where to start.
I mean, have you ever seen anything like this? I never have in all my years, and I've been politically conscious for maybe 40, 45 years, and I have never, ever, ever in my life seen a group like this Republican clutch. Never. It's just astonishing. I shudder to think that, you know, what would happen if one of these clowns became president, even though I've said, let's turn it all over to him. Who cares? Give it to him. That way the revolution will come a lot quicker. But
let me give you some hope.
All right.
I mean, kind of all the years, I guess it's been maybe 3 years since I've been calling, and all of the depressing things I've said, you know what? I mean, what has really perked me up a little bit, is that all the Republican people who surround me at work have been so disgusted by what they've heard.
Really?
Because, you know, the people that I work with, you have to remember, are doing what I'm doing mostly, which is we do the economy every day on our desks.
Right, right.
And we hear the hard stuff. And so these people who've been listening to the Republican I don't know what to call them. You're going to have to come up with that word.
Well,
but whatever they are,
yeah.
This herd of morons, I got to tell you something. Most of them are undecided.
Mm-hmm.
And which is incredible, really. It's incredible that these people have moved from all being Republican for a long, long time,
mm-hmm.
as long as I've known them,
mm-hmm.
which is a decade, and they are now, they're so dumbfounded by the stuff that they've heard
mm-hmm.
that they cannot bring themselves to vote for them. And so what may result is, and may be a prediction here, millions of Republicans staying home.
Well, I certainly can understand that. I try to imagine myself as a Republican being confronted with these clowns, and I can't do either. But
Well, these people are a good cross-section of people. I mean, we're talking about older, younger, experienced, not experienced. I mean, it's a good cross-section of people.
Well,
you
know, if you felt like it, of course, you can't do this at work, not because you're employed.
Oh, I say very little about it.
Right, exactly, but because you have to work with these folks. But somebody might point out to them over a beer sometime, to the average, and I know what you're talking about, average Republicans who are shocked and dumbfounded about this these nominees, these would-be candidates, I should say. Somebody ought to say to them, look, this is what your parties produce. These people weren't dropped off here on a flying saucer. This is what your political party over the past 30 years has produced. It's been a race to the bottom. These people were not produced by Democrats. They weren't produced by little trolls who live under a bridge somewhere in Bavaria. These are people that folks who have voted Republican, considered themselves Republican, acted as Republicans. This is what you've produced. So, you know, this gag reflex, and I can understand that. Take an average, educated, middle-class Republican who doesn't have a clue as to what's being said out there by these Republicans, and now all of a sudden they hear this stuff, and they think, what in the hell is this? And the only answer is, this is what you and your party have produced. This is not hard stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, all of these people, you're completely right on, as usual, by the way. and this is a result. We have come to the end result, basically, of 30 years of dumbing down. I mean, I don't know how much more you can dumb down, because these people, I mean, I'm actually a local elected official, and, we couldn't have people this dumb run for local offices.
Are you a JP or something?
JP, I'm a believe it or not, I'm a town meeting member, something I never knew existed since I grew up in a mid-Atlantic state, but in New England they have town meeting
members. Yeah, right. So you don't have JPs there. That's a justice of the peace.
No, I'm not a justice of the peace.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
yeah, but that's we couldn't have that here. I mean, we couldn't have that group of people. They just wouldn't make it. But I guess, to be serious for a second, really, the economy is not as scary, as whacked out. I don't know. I guess it's hard to put a measure on it, but that's not the worst that worries me. From this group of idiots, it's really their take on and the continuation of the insanity of our foreign policy. Where that may or may not go under a new Republican regime. And to be serious for a second,
that's the scary part. Yeah, that's the scary part. There is a stream of thought that goes through the collective consciousness that is Republican that has, you know, first of all, produce this crop of candidates, but secondly, that cares not a damn about human life. I don't care what they say about fetuses and so on and so forth. They care not a damn about human life.
Completely
and that's the part that scares me. When you have people who really don't care, and the way you can tell that, I don't mean average Republican pick up a gun and go out and shoot people on the street. I mean the average Republican would do anything in his power to deny that planet Earth is in desperate need of help, or we're all going to die. So in that sense, they're so pro-death that it's just madness. And
you know what, Mike? They don't even know why they are that way. They don't even know why.
Well, that's the thing.
I want to say something really quick. I want to say one thing real quick.
Real quick.
All your listeners who work for car companies, if you don't vote Democratic this time around, you really have to have your head examined, because President Obama and the Democratic Party saved you your jobs.
Well, that's true.
So no matter what you think about anything else, I want to tell you something. The food on your table is from that party and from that president. The other thing I wanted to say real quick is Marissa DeFranco and not Elizabeth Warren is the best Senate candidate the Democrats have.
Send me something about it, and I'll talk.
I will.
All right, Steve. Now
I will.
On.
I'll stay on the line.
Hold on. And congratulations for winning the trivia thingy. All right, Kathy will get the information. We're going to take a break. we're going to take a break when we come back. Prairie 2. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Subject line said they are called different names by different people, but they smell the same. He writes, the employer survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed 213,000 new private sector jobs created in December. Local governments in states controlled by Republicans were forced to cut 13,000 police, firefighters, and highway maintenance people for a net increase of 200,000 jobs. People in the red states continue to pay the price for having turned democracy over to the criminal class, and the rest of us will pay in the long term. It's true, at this rate of recovery, it will take 10 years to get us back to normal, but that assumes no positive feedback from the jobs created. It also assumes no further destruction of the economy by the Republicans. The other Bureau of Labor Statistics survey, the household survey, continues to show that employment numbers are recovering, and this lowering the job rate by 0.2% to 8.5%, period. Republicans continue to fault Obama for not keeping the rate below 8% as he had pledged, even though the last time it was this low was as George Bush was leaving office. If red state Republican operatives hadn't been able to eliminate 500,000 local government jobs, the current unemployment rate would be well under 8% and falling more rapidly than it is now. Good-paying government jobs not only bolster the infrastructure, which encourages growth, but also support other jobs in the private sector, increase home values, and support the local tax base. All the things the Republicans deliberately sabotage in order to drive the middle class to extinction. Deep down, Republican voters know this. That's why they can't agree on a frontrunner. The only constituency that gave Romney overwhelming support in the entrance polls at the Iowa caucus were voters making more than $100,000 a year. Now, this is big money in Iowa. The rest want that fictional Republican that doesn't exist. Santorum isn't well known and was that proverbial last straw to grasp when going down for the final time. Reports are that Santorum actually won the caucus, as discrepancies have appeared between the local counting of paper ballots and the numbers reported by the state party. Republicans having a hard time totaling the vote numbers. Who could imagine? I don't want to overstate the good news from the so-called recovery. It has more to do with the natural tendency of an economy to right itself like a boat in heavy seas than any action the president has taken. The Republicans, however, continue to drill holes in the bottom of the boat, knowing full well the outcome. We still need a trade policy, a manufacturing policy, an energy policy, a progressive tax policy, an education policy, single-payer health care policy, and on and on and on. The fact we are doing this well is a testament to the strength of the economy that FDR built after wrestling it from the clutches of the corporatists. Marx called them capitalists. Mussolini called them fascists. Hitler called them his friends. FDR called Prescott Bush and his ilk from the Wall Street banks economic royalists, and he welcomed their hatred. Obama has finally ignored the Republican filibuster and has started appointing people who will take on the economic royalists. We shouldn't put too much faith in the recovery, but we should take it as proof that Republicans are the reason we need a recovery and not some natural phenomenon or the work of Democrats. What we really need is to take matters into our own progressive hands. PrairieNumeral2.com. Go to his website. Boy, that last sentence. What we really need is to take matters into our own progressive hands. Once again, the faint whiff of revolution in the writings of Prairie 2. I can smell the torches. Ay, ay, ay. Daz is in Chicago. Daz, I got about 2 minutes here. Hi.
Hey, what's going on, Mike?
You are always going on.
All right, man. Okay, like I was telling Kathy. That the Republican nominee, I think, in the end will kind of sort of be incidental because they're all, like, you line them up, they're all completely crazy. But they're going to need to pull a stunt for the vice presidency, the same way they did last year, the last quadrennium cycle, whatever, with Palin.
Right.
So, you know, I think my choices are going to be either Victoria Jackson, the Mickey Mouse bow in her hand.
Victoria Jackson.
Or,
she's out of her mind. Have you been reading lately what this woman's been talking about?
I love every single
show. My God. I'm gonna have to do that at some point because I've got an article here about her. This woman is totally fried.
Out of her crawl space, man.
Really?
And so, I mean, the other one, which kind of sort of frightens me, but because he has so many fanboys, is Chuck Norris.
Oh, God. Oh, no, he's...
We have a black...
No, he's a real Nazi. You don't even want to think about Chuck Norris.
I know. I mean, that's why it frightens me, man. So
Chuck
they're
going
to do something like epic.
But you know, you could be right. Can you imagine a Santorum Chuck Norris ticket? Oh my God!
God, jeez. Oh, sweet baby Jesus.
How about Ted Nugent? Let's see. No, Ted Nugent would be Secretary of State.
Oh well, why not? You know.
Daz, I got a break here. Thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. Go Chicago. Call back again, okay? Good to hear from you, Daz. Take care, man.
And then we could make Gary Busey Secretary of Defense.
That's another freak. Some of these people, I don't know. What is it with white people? What is it with Caucasians that they
have? I hate white people.
You do? What is it with Caucasians that there are just, it seems like every single Caucasian that is in the public realm is nuts. I mean, Mel Gibson, Rick Santorum, Victoria Jackson. I mean, it never stops. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Broke my heart to find out Buffy's a Republican. Buffy!
It is 7 past the hour. You know, the corruption of language is a frequent focal point on this program. It's appalling the way language has been totally debased, inverted, perverted by the right wing, by the fascists in this country. It's awful. And it's not just in this country. Here's a quote for you. Let's see how quickly you can get this. He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. Right. George Orwell in the novel 1984. Actually, it was on a directive, I think, from the Ministry of Truth that eliminated any puzzlement that Winston Smith might have had as he stuffed bits of current events down the memory hole and went back and altered history. Going back and altered historical events is it is a requirement of dictatorships. You have to alter the past in order to manipulate the present. And if you alter the past, you control it. And if you control it, then you have absolute control over the future. And there are examples of this every place you look, in American politics and in global politics, all around the planet. Everybody does this. Everybody, that is, who is a fascist or a dictator. Now, critics of the Chilean government, which sadly is right-wing, critics are accusing the government there of similar attempts to whitewash history. It was revealed that they are purging the word dictator from school textbooks in relation to General Augusto Pinochet. The National Education Council in Chile. Why does this pertain to us? Well, you can figure it out. The National Education Council in Chile has declared that Pinochet's time in power between 1973 and 1990 should be described as a military regime, not a dictatorship. Thousands of Chileans were disappeared, killed, butchered, including Salvador Allende, who won the presidency of that country by a plurality. I think he got 43% of the vote, about the same amount that Bill Clinton got in 1992. But Allende, if you remember, wanted to take back from the globalists, the capitalists, most of whom were anchored with their talons in the United States. Allende wanted to take back and nationalize some of the industries that belonged to Chile. They were in Chile. They belonged to Chile. You know, when the Iranians tried to do this in 1953, we just overthrew their government. Central America, not Costa, was it not Costa Rica? Arbenz, Honduras? Why am I drawing a blank? Oh, my God. Anytime somebody tries to take back their country after a period of Guatemala, that's what it was, after a period of U.S. dominance, corporate dominance, and the people of that country get a little bit pissed off about that and say, hey, Indiana, come on, this is ours. And a socialist or a nationalist is elected president of the country, we usually send in the troops. And if we don't send in the troops, we'll send a hit squad. And if we don't send a hit squad, we will use our connections within the right wing of that country. It's always the right wing. You ever notice this? We never back left wing governments, never back left wing movements. Gee, I wonder why that is. Well, you know why it is. They're about social democracy or democratic socialism. And the right wingers are about utter capitalism, which in its finest point is fascism, or as Mussolini called it, corporatism, blah, 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 blah. So when Allende was elected, the Kissinger-Nixon regime in the United States couldn't tolerate that. Oh, no. This had to do with ITT. Remember ITT? I'm not talking about the online or the school, the technical school. ITT, International Telephone and Telegraph. And they had a huge stake in Chile. And Allende was going to nationalize various capitalist organizations there and turn them back to the people of Chile. And, of course, ITT said, nah, no, not us. And there were several other. There were other corporations based in the United States who prevailed upon Nixon and Kissinger to murder Allende. And they did. They had him murdered. This is how capitalism works. And it's in its finest moment, in its most abrupt moment, this is how it works. You know, free elections or elections that appear to be free are one thing, but God forbid that those elections should put in power someone who is not sympathetic to or owned by or controlled by the capitalists. If that happens, then that person is removed, period. I mean, come on. This is not hard stuff. And for those of you who sit there and say, well, doesn't this goddamn Malloy like anything about the United States? The quick answer is yes, but not the way our political economic system is run and the way it dominates and murders and slaughters and kills and butchers and commits genocide. No, I don't like that at all. Do you? Do you, Mr. or Ms. Right-Winger, do you like that? Huh? Ms. Conservative? Mr. Republican? Are you okay with that? If you are, goddamn your soul. Of course, I don't believe in any of that, but I'm just saying it for your benefit. Where was I? Oh, yeah. The National Education Council in Chile are eliminating, or is eliminating, the term dictatorship. Where it concerns General Augusto Pinochet, it will now be described, that regime, as a military regime that ran from 1973 to 1990 till the rotten old bastard died, during which human right abuses were widespread. Thousands of Chileans were murdered, disappeared, hanged, butchered, shot, thrown out of airplanes over the ocean. Anything to keep Mr. Pinochet in power and therefore satisfy the puppet masters in the United States, the capitalists. Harold Beyer, Chile's education minister, has claimed that the government was not involved in the decision. No, no! Not us! They have another right-wing government there. Not a military government, not a dictatorship, but a right-wing government. Kind of like the Bush-Cheney regime. Kind of like the Obama regime. Harold Beyer, Chile's education minister, said, quote, it is about using the same expression that is used around the world, a more general term such as military regime. Then he said he personally had no problem in acknowledging that Pinochet was a dictator. But, now, opposition is developing among several parliamentarians in Chile, according to what I have in front of me, including the daughter of Pinochet, who was killed in the coup, the father was. The BBC reports that Senator Isabel Allende described the decision as a scandal and added, quote, it goes against all common sense because the whole world knows that for 17 years what we had in Chile was a ferocious dictatorship with the most serious violation of human rights, end quote. Former Chilean President Eduardo Frei said, quote, history cannot be changed by a decree or a law. There is only one history, and it is clear. It was a dictatorship, full stop. Allende, I'm sorry, Pinochet died of a heart attack in 2006. I didn't mean to imply that he was in power until his death. He was in power for 17 years. This dispute is the latest controversy to hit President Sebastián Piñera since he was elected in 2010. And Piñera, of course, is a right-winger. He is not a fascist dictator, not yet, but give him enough time. Now, what does this have to do with us? Well, I'll draw the connection for you here when we come back. Stay with us.
redefining anger management. Back to Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. So, language. He who controls language, blah, blah, blah. In Chile, they're no longer going to use the word dictator in reference to Augusto Pinochet. This is a decision being made by the right-wing government there. In this country, David Sirota, who is, in addition to being a talk show host on AM 760 in Denver, he also is a best-selling author of new book, Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now. And he also writes a column for Creator Syndicate. David is very busy. he's talking here about words and phrases that are soon to be eliminated from our vernacular, from the idiomatic American English. Some of idiomatic, some of it not. But the point he's trying to make is pretty much the same as what is occurring right now in Chile, getting rid of the word dictatorship where it concerns Pinochet. He says, David does, he has a list of 10 phrases that are going to disappear. Civil liberties. Civil liberties. He says, my son will surely read the U.S. Constitution in civics class, and he'll see stuff about rights to jury trials, due process, protection from unreasonable searches. But these freedoms have been extinguished by presidents successively claiming powers of indefinite detention, warrantless surveillance, and assassination of American citizens without charge. Assuming there's still an ACLU that sends me mail, and assuming my son sees the mail, he might ask, what are civil liberties, Dad? My answer will be, good question. David does not mention that prominent among those presidents is Barack Obama. Another phrase that will soon possibly disappear, public school. Public school. David says, with the for-profit education industry successfully pushing to privatize public education, I pray there's a decent public school left for my son to attend. At least then there's a chance he'll know what one is. Yeah, public education, as most people who are paying attention to this understands, especially if you're a school teacher, public education has got to stop. Because public employees have a tendency to teach the truth when they work in a school system. Now, that's not to close my eyes to the fact that there are bad teachers, there are bad principals. We had an enormous scandal here in the Atlanta area of school principals and administrators cheating on achievement tests in order to make the students look as though they had performed better than they had, because educational achievement under Bush became a money proposition, and it was tied to the grades that little kids got. And we've talked about this before. You cannot take a population of school children who come from broken homes or a home where somebody's an addict, or they didn't have breakfast or supper the night before. They don't know if what's going to happen to mom and dad now that the jobs are gone. The house is about to be foreclosed on. Whether the parents own it or just renting it is immaterial. All of that factors in to the ability of a child to go to school 7 hours a day and pay attention. But never mind to right-wingers. Oh, the school's failing. Here, let's turn over to private enterprise. They're real successful. So, Sirota is correct. Public school is a phrase that probably soon will disappear. Another one, budget surplus. Budget surplus. Kids that go to school 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now will have no idea what the term even references. Right? Here's another one, potable water. Sirota says, no doubt in the shadow of ubiquitous oil and gas rigs, I'll tell my son of the halcyon days when drinking water was widely available. I'll also tell him that when he was a toddler, lawmakers ignored warnings that oil and gas drilling threatened to contaminate groundwater. Granted, I'll sound like the Lorax. Unfortunately, my son won't be a Dr. Seuss tale. My story won't be a Dr. Seuss tale. It will be real. So look for potable water, another term to disappear. Here's one that's almost already dead. Union, even as states limit collective bargaining rights and corporations bust organizing drives, my son will somehow still know this word. The problem is that he'll insist it's a Civil War era synonym for North. And that's all. There's about five more of them here. Stick around.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. Okay. Words that are going to disappear, according to David Sirota, words and phrases: civil liberties, public school, budget surplus, potable water, union, peace, peace. There's one for you, peace. As Sirota points out, the Afghanistan war presses on unabated. Meanwhile, Wired magazine notes that a permanent presence of private security contractors means that our military efforts in Iraq aren't coming to an end. And covert operations continue in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. David writes that his son might encounter peace when he reads Orwell and sees the phrase, war is peace. But he'll probably take that phrase literally. In what the Pentagon now deems, quote, the era of persistent conflict, end quote. Endless, what is it? Endless, perpetual war for perpetual peace, of course. Another phrase that's disappearing, soon will be gone, democracy. How can a presidential candidate win without the most votes? That's what the average kid is going to ask as he approaches voting age. Sirota says, how can 40 senators filibuster everything? Why are corporations allowed to buy politicians? What's democracy, Dad? Dead silence will follow. Another phrase is going to disappear. We're all in this together. Sirota writes, I'll try to teach my boy the values inherent in that slogan of solidarity, but in this gilded age of avarice, I fear I'll hear in return that American motto, which is, greed is good, Daddy! Newspapers. University of Southern California researchers predict that within 5 years, quote, only four major daily newspapers will continue in print, end quote. Tragically, that suggests that when I explain my career and I show my kid a newspaper, I'll be pointing at a museum's glass case, Sirota writes. And last but not least, the word journalism. At that same museum, Sirota says, you'll find the newspaper you might be reading this column in. And I'll show my son the surrounding articles reporting on real issues in local communities. I'll tell him what he's looking at is the lost art of journalism. And I can only hope he doesn't respond by asking me if I was fair and balanced. David Sirota. You can listen to him on AM 760 in Denver. Thanks, David. So it's not just in Chile where the word dictatorship is going to be replaced, where it concerns Augusto Pinochet, with the term military government. Meanwhile, this caught my eye. This has really nothing to do with anything except for the Mount Everest of double standards that Caucasians use against people of color. The Mount Everest. I mean, it's just astonishing sometimes, isn't it? And American conservatives are almost identified by their hypocrisy where it concerns racial issues in this country. Oh, my God. It hardly bears even getting into. But this comes from the UK. There is a member of parliament there. Her name is Diane Abbott. She happens to be, what's the term there? Afro-English? Would that be the term? She's a black woman, and she is now stands accused of racism. And she's being asked to resign from the Labour front bench. She's been in a member of parliament for a quarter of a century, but she's being asked to resign after claiming that white people love playing, quote, divide and rule, end quote. What happened was she sent a message to a freelance journalist on Twitter, on the Twitter site. And she wrote, Diane Abbott wrote, quote, white people love playing divide and rule. We should not play their game, end quote. You know where this is going already, don't you, right? Huh? That's what she wrote. White people love playing divide and rule. We should not play their game. So, and Miss Abbott used a hashtag which spelled tactics as old as colonialism. Oh, no, no, no. We don't want to talk about colonialism. We don't want to talk about murdering, butchering, and otherwise eliminating indigenous peoples as the Caucasians spread out. And not just Caucasians. No, no, no. It's just the Caucasians have, you know, the longest history of doing this sort of thing. And a lot of Caucasians are trying to make amends, trying to get over it, trying to move on, trying to appreciate the historical blood work that they perpetrated against other folks on this planet. And let's hope that that apology is accepted because, oh, never mind. Anyway, when asked for a comment in response to this, Diane Abbott, member of parliament, told the Huffington Post in the UK, quote, I'm going to have to get back to you on that, end quote. She later tweeted that she had been taken out of context. Oh, please. And she apologized for any offense caused. Why do people feel compelled to apologize for the truth? They feel it's a political necessity, obviously. Now, Diane Abbott, who is an MP from Hackney in the UK, obviously does not represent a majority white constituency. I say obviously because that Hackney, her base of operations, is not predominantly white. Consequently, she has to apologize for any offense caused, even though she merely spoke the truth. A conservative member of parliament, of course, has called for Ms. Abbott to quit her front bench job as shadow public health minister or for her to be sacked by Labour leader Ed Miliband. And former Tory MP and commentator Paul Goodman has also called for her to quit, saying her comments were, get this, racist. Her comments were racist. Jesus Christ. Apparently this guy doesn't understand the definition of the term racist. Um, And Paul Goodman, the former right-wing member of parliament, said, quote, even the most clear-cut apology won't do, end quote. What did Diane Abbott say? What did this black woman, member of parliament, say? White people love playing divide and rule. We shouldn't play their game. Oh, Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, isn't he a liberal? Has said Miss Abbott should, quote, apologize and explain herself. And he called the comments stupid and crass. Really? Stupid and crass. You know, one is forced, if one is named Mike Malloy, one is forced to immediately consider what the liberal, the Labour government of Tony Blair in a criminal enterprise with the Bush crime family, what they did in a country, Afghanistan, what they did in a country, Iraq, one can stop right there and consider whether or not that was stupid and crass. In comparison with Diane Abbott, a black member of the British Parliament, saying white people love playing divide and rule, we should not play their game. A Labour spokesperson said, quote, we disagree with Diane's tweet. It is wrong to make sweeping generalizations about any race, creed, or culture. The Labour Party has always campaigned against such behavior. And so has Diane Abbott. So, a black female member of the British Parliament who said white people love playing divide and rule, we should not play their game, is now being attacked by conservatives as well as liberals and Labourites alike in the British Parliament for doing the unforgivable, whether it is the Chilean government, the American media, or the British Parliament, and that is speaking the truth. Speaking the truth. I have some more truth for you here as soon as we come back from this break regarding the Keystone XL pipeline. A whistleblower, a former Bechtel engineer, an inspector that worked for, indirectly, for the company building this. He was an inspector to take a look at TransCanada's work. And he found some things that were pretty shocking. And, well, I'll tell you about it since we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour, Mike Klink is an engineer, and as he states in a piece that he wrote for a newspaper in Lincoln, Nebraska, the Journal Star, he wrote an op-ed piece. He's an engineer. He's not telling people they shouldn't build pipelines. He's just telling people that the Keystone XL pipeline should not be built. I found this at thinkprogress.org. And the It starts out by saying that by forcing the White House to make a decision on this toxic Keystone XL pipeline as part of that agreement reached in December to extend the payroll tax, the Republicans, once again, are trying to undercut federal environmental review process in order to satisfy their capitalist owners, the people who own them, these filthy pig Republicans. Anyway, a whistleblower, Mike Klink, is now stating that the company overseeing the development of this project, the company called TransCanada, has a track record of undercutting quality at the expense of the environment and blah, blah, blah. Let me share with you what he wrote. I don't know how much of this I can get in, but he says he wrote this for the newspaper in Lincoln, Nebraska. Remember, this thing was originally routed over the certain environmentally fragile area of Nebraska. He writes, there's been a lot of talk about the safety of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. I'm not an environmentalist, but as a civil engineer and an inspector for TransCanada during the construction of the first Keystone pipeline, I've had an uncomfortable front row seat to the disaster that Keystone XL could bring all along its pathway. Despite its boosters' advertising, this project is not about jobs or energy security. It is about money. And whenever my former employer, Bechtel, working on behalf of TransCanada, had to choose between safety and saving money, they chose to save money. As an inspector, my job was to monitor the construction of the first Keystone pipeline. I oversaw construction at the pump stations that have been such a problem on that line, which has already spilled more than a dozen times. I'm coming forward because my kids encouraged me to tell the truth about what was done and covered up. When I last raised concerns about corners being cut, I lost my job. The people along the Keystone XL pathway have a lot more to lose if this project moves forward. What did I see? Cheap foreign steel that cracked when workers tried to weld it. Foundations for pump stations that you would never consider using in your own home. Fudged safety tests. Bechtel staffers explaining away leaks during pressure tests as, well, not too bad. Shortcuts on the steel and rebar that are essential for safe pipeline operation. And siting of facilities on completely inappropriate spots like wetlands. I shared these concerns with my bosses, who communicated them to the bigwigs at TransCanada, but nothing changed. TransCanada didn't appear to care. That's why I was not surprised to hear about the big spill in Ludden, North Dakota, where a 60-foot plume of crude spewed tens of thousands of gallons of toxic tar sands oil and fouled neighboring fields. TransCanada says that the performance has been okay. 14 spills is not so bad, and that the pump stations don't really count. That's all bunk. This thing shouldn't be leaking like a sieve in its first year. What do you think happens decades from now after moving billions of barrels of the most corrosive oil on the planet? Let's be clear. I'm an engineer. I'm not telling you we shouldn't build pipelines. We just should not build this one. And he closes, there's a little bit more, but he closes, please do not sell out to foreign oil and foreign suppliers. There is no guarantee the product will stay in the United States. Only the toxic waste. God bless the United States and those of us who still believe in the fact that people matter. Mike Klink lives in Auburn, Indiana. He is seeking whistleblower protection from the U.S. Department of Labor. And this appeared in the Journal Star, the Lincoln, Nebraska newspaper, the Journal Star. You can find it at thejournalstar.com if you want to. The Keystone XL pipeline, of course, I think most of us know by now, is something that is going to, when it's built, and there's a good chance it will be built, although that decision has been put off now until after the upcoming election in November. If it is built, it will fail. It will fail when billions of gallons of the most toxic, corrosive oil on Earth is coursing through this pipeline as it transfers across the United States. It's going to erupt. is going to erupt over the Ogallala Aquifer, which is one of the most critical underwater rivers, call it, water supply that provides water for the Midwest, for the farming areas. And when it does erupt, it is going to cause a disaster that will dwarf anything that has ever happened environmentally, in an environmentally negative way, in the United States and possibly any place on Earth. Just extracting this stuff from the from where it's located is going to release the amount of toxic material into the atmosphere that has been referred to by several experts as game over where it concerns global climate change. That once this stuff is released into the atmosphere, just in the extraction process, we're not talking about it's being burned as fuel, but in the extraction process, once that occurs, then as far as global climate change is concerned, it's game over. I'll see you Monday. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kenny, wherever you are.